listening to We the Rapscast, the Toronto Raptors radio show. You can find us on Dash Radio at 4:30 p.m. Eastern on Tuesdays till 6 p.m. and in podcast form on iTunes, Stitcher, AlmightyBaller.com, and everywhere else that fine podcasts can be found. Now, I'm with a man who thinks it's kind of funny, thinks it's kind of sad. The dreams in which he's dying are the best he's ever had. It's at Rusty Pedal Bike on Twitter. Russell Pedal, it's a mad world. I'm Dan Grant, and at Slam and Danny G on Twitter. And Russell, I mean, things are pretty crazy for Raptors fans right now.
Yeah, no kidding. You really nailed it with that intro. It's a sad time for me right now.
I noticed on social media that you went to a really you're normally a pretty upbeat guy. You're normally pretty positive, and you're able to kind of you know. Find a medium ground, but after that loss on Saturday night, the Raptors lost to the Bucks 98-83, and Russell, you went to a dark place.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad time over at Rusty Pedal Bike right now on Twitter.
Yeah.
I have to say, as you said, like I'm usually defending the team, one of the more upbeat Raptors bloggers, I would think.
Yeah.
Definitely always saying like, no, come on guys, everything's great, everything's fine. And I still believe that deep down, and I still think the Raptors will win this series. And I, you know, this curse of game ones dating back several years now, especially on home court, it's getting hard to watch. But it's, you know, I think what it all comes down to is having so many people say it and like without any type of analysis, just be like, yeah, well, game ones, they're going to lose. And then holding it over you and stuff like that. And then it's like, no, this team is better. They have playoff experience now. That's not going to happen. They're way better than the Bucks. This isn't like when they faced that Nets team and they were pretty good and the Wizards were pretty good. And, this should be fine now. And then it just all came true. And then it was a lot of like, see, I told you, game ones, you know, it's just, they don't have it. You know,
yeah. So PJ Tucker did not care for that. I don't know if you saw his comments when.
No, I didn't.
He was asked kind of about that whole thing, and in typical intense PJ Tucker fashion, he said, "No, I don't buy that. I don't think everyone's saying it's okay that we lose game ones." He's like, "No, it isn't. That was not okay." And he was very much like, that he wasn't tolerating that talk at all. And yeah, it was. He didn't think it was even amusing. And this is obviously the first one he's been here for. But I don't know if they wouldn't have made the playoffs his year when he's here. Anyway, he wouldn't have been on the roster or playing. So, it doesn't matter. The point is, that kind of an attitude is, I think, a positive that you can take away that, they're not satisfied. It's not just a shrug your shoulders. What can you do kind of thing. They're actively looking to figure out what went wrong in that game because there was, a smorgasbord of things that we can talk about, and as we will over the next hour and a half.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so,
I like that. That was the first I've heard of those comments from PJ Tucker, and I like that. You can't just be like, "Oh yeah, well, game ones," you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's lazy.
He didn't even go like, "Oh, I didn't know that," or "Oh, that's kind of interesting." Like he was not having it. He was like, "No, like that's not something that's acceptable, and it's not where we expect to be, where they, I don't think he said this, but paraphrasing, they're the favorite team in the series and they are, a better team than the Bucks and they have been all season long. And obviously they didn't play better in game one. So that's not acceptable. And I appreciate him just being very candid and saying that. So as you mentioned, Russell, it's been a dark place over at Rusty Pedal Bike. So I thought something that we could do instead of going through Raptors past, present and future, like we normally do, because obviously it's the playoffs and we've only been through one game. Game two going tomorrow night. I would rank a few things that happened in game one, and obviously it's a small sample. I wanted to rank your panic level for these five things that I came up with. So I want you to tell me if you're panicked or not panicked about these things. You don't have to necessarily give a rating. Maybe figure out a rating for this next time we do it, but just tell me whether or not you think how worried you are about these things, panic or no panic. Does that sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay. Number one. And, these aren't in any particular order, just for the listening benefit. They're just as they came to me. So number one, I'm going to say, Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Yeah. Lots of panic.
Yeah. Active panic.
Active panic. Very active panic.
Yeah.
Like, no, he's as advertised, right? He's a superstar. He's really, broken out this year. And, you know, as a player that has played in the playoffs before, this isn't like his playoff debut, but I mean,
no.
The first go around wasn't earth shattering by any stretch of the imagination, and this time around, yeah, he really just had one hell of a game, and his fingerprints were all over it. He shot an amazing 13 for 18 from the field. He scored awesome. 10 fast break points by himself. He scored 18 points in the paint. 18.
That's tough. I mean, that's where we talked about it in the preview podcast. That's the place you don't want to let him get, and he obviously had his way in there.
He did. It just seemed like there was no resistance to him getting to the tin, and that's a problem. He shot very well, and very well on contested shots. Like, the Raptors met him at the rim, but no one could get up and stop him, you know?
Yeah, I saw that he was 3 of 3 from mid-range, which he's normally like a 30% shooter from mid-range.
Yeah, good catch.
So, yeah.
And, yeah, he had some really emphatic dunks. And, of course, that big block, which we'll talk about a little later, on DeRozan. Just the whole thing, the whole package. Like, he was not only did he perform well in the box score, but, like, he just had some really game-changing moments that really, you know, that everything we talked about in the preview in the last episode was very much like, you know, if he can be the best player in this series, then he can give the Bucks their best chance at winning a game or two. Mm-hmm. And he did precisely that in Game 1. Now, I don't put a lot of stock in this concept of the Raptors always losing Game 1s, and that's the way it is and the way it will always be. Like, Game 1 is just any other game. Like, they're not – that's a funny coincidence, but the whole point is that the Bucks came out a lot more ready than I think the Raptors gave them credit for. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what they do to adjust in the next game. But, I'm worried about Antetokounmpo and what's going to happen with him. Because, I mean, you look at, you know, Damari Carroll could do nothing to stop him, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some good questions about Damari later on.
Yeah, so it's really just finding a way to limit him, or at least, you know, limit everyone else. Like, you got to take the paint away from him. Like, he scored... You know, yeah, 18 points in the paint for a single player is too many, especially for a non-center.
Totally. Yep. Yeah, I agree. I think, I think the fact that he was doing whatever he wanted, I'd find it'd be hard pressed for me to believe that he'd have a better game than that, kind of in terms of efficiency and in the paint. So that's obviously that's not a positive, but if you can even just tone that back 10-15%, I think that's really, really going to help. The fact that the Bucks, as a team, only shot, even though Giannis shot 13 of 18, the Bucks only shot 44.7%, which isn't amazing. Yeah, so, right. If he's going to do that, and you can just see how athletic he is when he gets to the rim, as you said, those hammer dunks, and he's just freakish out there. I mean, not to pun on his nickname or anything, but. Yeah. It's wild to see what he can do. And you can see why everyone's been kind of raving about his long-term potential. But I think there's, you know, little things to be gleaned from that. I'm not super surprised that the Bucks came out firing. You know, they're on the road. They're a young team. There's not a ton of pressure on them. They've been playing really well the last month or 6 weeks. And they just kind of came out with no fear. They've got some older veterans on the team. You know, Jason Terry, guys like that who have been there before. And I'm sure we're in the ear of the young guys. And it sucks, and it was a really bad game, but it's not, for me, it wasn't what the Bucks did so much as what the Raptors didn't do. And I think we can get to that with the next panic question, which is, I want you to talk about, these are two separate questions, Kyle Lowry's play and Kyle Lowry's attitude. Which has you panicked or not panicked, or do they both have you panicked, or are you okay with both?
The attitude doesn't really bother me that much. He's okay. He's a bit of a history of kind of saying some things sometimes where you kind of go, I don't know, you know, you don't like the way he words everything he says. And I think he was pretty emotional after Game 1.
Yeah, and that's fair.
You know, at the same time, there might be a lot being put on his. It's a lot to put on his shoulders to be just coming back from injury and be in basically your fifth game back and to be held up. you know, in game one, you're in much more of a spotlight on you, and he's still working his way back into game shape to an extent. So he obviously was playing big minutes right from the get-go when he came back, but, you know, just getting in the rhythm of all that. So, yeah, his attitude, I assume you're referring to his comments about forcing shots?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I honestly, I'm going to be honest, I didn't see the video of that. I read transcripts and a lot of different takes on that, et cetera. For me, it didn't bug me too much, but I wanted to hear your thoughts about the forcing shots comment.
Yeah. Do you remember what the exact quote was?
Yeah, they basically were asking about him being aggressive or, you know, not being aggressive or whatever. And he said, my teammates want me, he's like, I was going in there, I was seeing forearms all the time, but my teammates want me to be more aggressive. I guess I'm going to have to force up some more shots. And he used the word force twice. It wasn't like a mistake. I'm kind of paraphrasing that there, but that was the gist of it.
Okay, you did a good job. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't know the quote was about his teammates. So that's a little troubling because...
Yeah, he said that twice, so that my teammates want me to be more aggressive.
Okay. Okay, I've got the exact quote here. I'll read it. My teammates want me to be more aggressive, so I'm going to have to force some more shots. Simple as that, because I felt like I made the right passes last night, but my teammates, I guess I'll be forcing more shots, put it that way. You got forearms on you, but I got to be more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's someone like, you know, Ibaka or Tucker was in his ear. Actually, that makes me think of, there was a moment where during the game, the broadcast I was watching highlighted Ibaka, DeRozan, Lowry, and Tucker on the bench, and Tucker was giving the guys an earful, and Lowry looked to be taking exception to what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So that feels like it's a reaction to that. Now, I'm just guessing at that. I have no evidence of that or anything, but...
Mm-hmm. It's fair enough, though. It's a fair observation.
Yeah, so he played really poorly, and I'm glad that he said, like, I've got to play better for the team to win, and he took onus for the loss. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think it's a bit of a petty comment to make in the media afterwards, so hopefully he'll have his head back around him. But if I'm concerned about his attitude, if I'm panicking about it, no, I mean, this is the player that I've known the whole time. He does have moments where he gets like that, so I'm not going to fault him for that after a very tough loss in a game that they should have won. And especially, like I said, given the history of them losing game ones, and if just imagining how frustrated I was to have to deal with people's comments about the Raptors and how they're chokers and how they're not mentally tough and all this. And then, you know, if I were in Lowry's shoes, he has every right to be like 10 times more frustrated than I am. So I totally get that. Like, I didn't want to, I wanted to like sign off from Twitter and not be anywhere near it, because I'm just so sick of defending this. I defend this team so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I have for so long, and to then have this all happen, like, I've just wanted to get away from it all. So I can completely understand why he'd get like that. So I'm not going to panic about his attitude, but to answer your other question, to panic about his play, yeah, I'm at the point now where I'm legit concerned. Like, it's at the point now where his playoff stats just stink. And I remember even portions of last year or whatever saying like, no, he'll come around. He's too good of a player. I talk constantly about how he's one of the most important Raptors in the team's history. We talk about him being the most valuable player on this team over DeRozan a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the playoffs, like, he's just not a proven playoff performer. And now it's starting to make me like, I'm still on team. Like, okay, they have to re-sign him. They're dedicated to this backcourt. I mean, you signed DeRozan last year. You want to keep these two together. Like, that's my honest opinion.
Yep.
But it is troubling to me that he is such a horrible playoff performer. And there's enough evidence now. He's played 32 games in a Raptors uniform, 32 playoff games,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he's been pretty bad overall for the whole stretch. Like, he's, you know, has the occasional good game. Of course, last year, even when his shot wasn't going, he was contributing in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the sad thing on Saturday with game one, is that he seemed bad for the team all the way around. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't a lot he was doing that you can walk away and go like, okay, he at least he did this, or at least he did that. Right.
Yeah.
Like,
he got totally fair. Yeah.
He got six assists. Fine. But, you know, He just missed too many shots and just, like, was completely out of control in some points. And I found, like, you know, I'd like for him to be able to slow it down. And, like, you'd like to think that the playoff experience and just being, like, a top point guard in the league would help him stop and dictate the pace a bit more. And I just feel like he didn't take the time to do that.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, one of the things you always hear with him, and one, something I would always lean on when defending him in the past, is that he's never been healthy for the playoffs. But one of the big Zach Lowian things is that staying healthy in the NBA is a skill.
Yeah.
Being able to, whether it doesn't really matter why he's not performing at this point. It's just something that has to change. And if it doesn't change, then that kind of, you have to reevaluate based on the results. It doesn't really, the why, obviously you have to consider the why, but if the why isn't going to change, then at that point you have to evaluate what you have based on the reality of the situation. And for Lowry, it's that he hasn't been good in the playoffs, and it sucks to say, because like all those things you're just saying, would you ever have used those words to describe Kyle Lowry during the regular season? Like out of control, struggling with a shot, forcing things. He looks like, all those, he has to help the team more. That's like, he's the antithesis of what he is during the regular season. It's such a strange thing to see him play that way. Now, this year specifically, if you want to throw out the other years and we just talk about this year, this Bucks team right now is probably the best team he's played since coming back, considering the Cavs sat their guys.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. Yeah.
So, and they're, they have a lot of decent defenders. They have decent defenders on the perimeter. And we don't know how his wrist feels. We don't know, like you said, him getting back into game shape, how that's going.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not using those as excuses, but next game is kind of the game where if it happens again, then, it's full-blown panic time, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, 32 games is not a small sample.
No.
We're at the point now where this might be who he is. And, if you want to blame it on health, not saying you want to blame it on health, but, you brought up the health thing. It's like, okay, well, it's a bad thing if he's unhealthy for, the better part of 32 games.
Yeah.
Spread out over, four years. And then on top of that, he's getting older, and what's he all of a sudden going to become healthier as he gets older?
Unlikely.
It's troubling. So, I'm still team Lowry. I still say he's one of the best Raptors in the team's history and stuff, but I, as much as I want the team to re-sign him, this is troubling. I really want him to turn it around and prove me wrong, but, yep. I'm finding it really hard to defend his mental fortitude right now. When it comes to being able to perform in the playoffs, it's just too long of a history of bad things happening, and it's with this core, right? As much as last year's run was great, it wasn't easy by any stretch of the imagination. And if they're falling right back into these things again, I'd hate to think that by the time this core is finished, and whether that be Kyle not signing with the team this summer. If all of a sudden we've seen the end of the Kyle DeMar era, so to speak, and, we had basically very little positive to say about what they contributed in the playoffs. Okay, good regular season team. Mm-hmm. And that's about it,
Yeah, it's tough. That would be a tough thing to see happen.
Because even Vince, when Vince was there, you had the big 50-point games against Philly and he definitely stepped it up a notch, and you'd like to see these guys do that.
Yeah.
Because, Lowry, DeRozan had a better game one, but I mean, he still shot poorly.
Yeah, 7 of 21. That's not great.
Yeah, exactly. The two of them now are just, both of them have very spotty playoff records. And as much as everyone says, you're not going to be a championship team if your best player is DeMar DeRozan and stuff like that, right? And you kind of go well, okay, fine. But in all reality, if you compare them to other superstars or other stars, I should say, at least other stars can step up in the playoffs. You see guys like Jimmy Butler, Paul George,
yep.
John Wall, all these different players that are in, not quite the same category, but at least other all-stars, and you don't see them just completely choke year after year. So that's definitely got me down and got me panicked a bit, the whole thing.
It's fair. And that's, back to the attitude thing, just for me, given everything that he's been through, I get why Kyle will be frustrated. And if you followed any of the stuff, listening to his growth as a person. You know, when he came out of Villanova and, you know, struggled and kind of bounced around the league and had attitude problems and fought with Kevin McHale in Houston. And when he first got to Toronto, he fought with Dwayne Casey. And he talked a lot about his growth and maturity and how things have changed. And, you know, he's learned to communicate better. And that's all stems from his home life growing up and all that stuff. To see him react so negatively, I guess, you know, that he cares probably more than anyone. And that's a positive thing. But at this point, as you said, he's 31 years old and he's been through this before. For him to say stuff like that in the media is just, it just shows bad judgment. Like, it shows that he's kind of too emotional about it. And I appreciate the emotion because you want a guy that cares. You don't want a guy that's, that obviously is just like, oh, you know, whatever, we'll get him next time and doesn't really give a shit. But like, I appreciate that it comes from a place of him caring. But you want someone who's more in control. And I think the fact that he's been out, the fact that he hasn't had the time to mesh with these guys, and you said, you talked about Tucker taking him to task on the bench and him not getting along or not, you know, not liking what he was hearing. That's the kind of stuff that you miss when he's out in the regular season. And again, it comes back to his health. If he had been there to gel with those guys down the stretch, maybe that's a conversation they had 2 weeks ago. And it's not a conversation you have in game one of the playoffs. With all that said, I think that the Raptors are still better than the Bucks. We're going to talk about that later. And I think that it just, if the Raptors didn't have such a crappy record in game ones, I don't think this would be such a big deal for Raptors fans. But it's just because it's such a familiar feeling, I think it kind of fills everyone with a sense of dread.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Because the funny thing is people are coming away from this, like the general, and I say people, I mean like things I've read on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Are coming away from this.
Those are people.
Those are people too.
Maybe.
But I mean, I tend to talk about that as general consensus. Like everyone's saying X, Y, or Z when really I just read a couple of people say that on Twitter. But anyway, my whole point being a lot of people are down on the Raptors after that game one loss. And more so that I think than people are down on the Bucks after losing to the Bulls. Celtics after losing to the Bulls and they're the one seed. Or the fact that the Cavaliers were one shot away from losing game one at home to the Pacers. Yeah. And, you know, the Bucks are a better team than those two teams. So, yeah, I'm not, I've got to try and, if it weren't, like you said, if it weren't for those game ones, I don't think we would have to be as concerned.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Okay, so we've got two panics and one no panic. So let's see if we can swing it back to the no panic in the next few. So, number four, Russell, I want you to tell me whether you're panicked or no panic about all the NBA players outside of... You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, we lost you for a second, but we can still keep going, right?
All right, cool.
All right, so Russell's here. Okay, so I'm going to just start the question over again. I want to ask you about number four, which is all the Raptors players, outside of our kind of big core unit. So the role players, Corey Joseph, Damari Carroll, you know, the other guys. I mean, PJ was pretty good in the first game, but Patrick Patterson, how was the play of those players in the first game? How are you feeling?
I think overall it wasn't too bad. I got to put a lot on the starters because they're the ones, you know, with the really bad plus minuses.
Yep.
So like those units weren't working very well, whereas the like bench units were working okay. You know, you look at the shooting of some of those guys, you know, there wasn't much to take away from it and be happy about, but at the end of the day I found like what they did so much less than guys like DeRozan and Lowry were trying to do, and even Ibaka had a very good game one. But you look at the guys that you just mentioned and they don't have good shooting lines or whatever, but overall when they were on the floor, like the team was fairly even with the Bucks. So mm-hmm. I can't help but look at that and say like, well, you know, they did what was asked of them. They are bench players for a reason. So, or in Carroll's case, like, you know, he's obviously a role player and a fifth option in that lineup. So, you know, I don't think I can put too much of this on them. It would have been nice to see them step up and maybe we could have gotten more from someone else, considering how bad Lowry was. Like when you know, usually when you're looking at this team, you're wondering who's going to be the third option behind DeRozan and Lowry. But if Lowry's not performing, then all of a sudden who's going to be that third option has to be a good second option. And you got that out of Ibaka, mm-hmm. but then no one else really stood out. So, Valanciunas had his moments and everything, but, yeah, I'm not walking away with too much panic on those guys. I think that in any given game, one of them can really catch fire or do something. Like, I'm expecting there to be a big Valanciunas game somewhere in this series. I'm expecting mm-hmm. there to be a game where Carroll hits two or three three-pointers, or a game where Patterson does that or anything like that, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. I think that was a question that was kind of motivated by the Bucks. You saw a lot of the Bucks role players kind of step up and do their jobs really, really well. Like, Thon McCur had a really great stretch on defense in the third quarter. Brogdon had a great game.
Tony Snell hit three triples.
Yeah, Tony Snell shot like 43% from three this year. So yeah. He's kind of a guy, you know, that's that Bucks kind of MO. They're athletic, they pass well, and they shoot the three. But Middleton had a crappy shooting game, but dropped 9 assists. Was a team leading plus 27, just doing what he does. Greg Monroe off the bench was a load. Like, those little things can make a huge difference when your stars aren't having great games. So, like you said, it kind of sucks that no one on the Raptors really did that in the first game, especially the shooting. But the whole offense, especially in the second half, was just so it wasn't stagnant, but it just looked just out of sync. There were too often, which is a weird thing to say, trying to make the extra pass. They had open shots, they were passing up. There were things getting deflected all over the place, and then when they wound up taking shots, they weren't hitting open looks or anything, really. I think they shot 20% in the second half. Is that right? Do you have that number?
I don't have it directly.
You don't have it? Anyway, they shot 36% on the game and 21% from three for the full game. So I'm pretty sure the number I saw was that they shot 20%.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I have it now. I just didn't have it directly in front of me, but I managed to get it. They shot 7 for 35, which is 20%, yeah.
Oh, that is just atrocious, right? Like, I can't imagine they had a worst half shooting the entire season.
No, probably not.
Yeah,
it's,
so...
It's really horrible.
Yeah, so there's just not much you can do about that. I think you have to accept it kind of as an aberration and fix, obviously, the things that led to that, but... like you said, I'm not too panicked with the role guys either. I think they need to put them in a better position to succeed, but I think it's going to be that one's a no panic for me.
Yeah, well, to your point, I mean, the Raptors had two players score in double figures in DeRozan and Ibaka, and the Bucks had six.
Right.
So yeah, what it comes down to really is that, you know, they had more happening around them. Like, if you look at Antetokounmpo, yeah, he stood out. So you had your big player stand out more, and then you had your bench role player stand out more. So is it going to be like that every single game? No, certainly not. Like I said, the main point I wanted to make is, like, about the DeRozan and Lowry, you need them to be consistent and to be big performers every single game. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the players that you mentioned after that, the role players, they need to, you know, occasionally step up and be like the third best player or the fourth best player in a game to really give your team a good chance. But it still trickles down from the stars, and if they don't perform, then, you know, someone else needs to step up huge, and if no one does, you know, it's hard to hold it against them because that's not usually their job to do.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. All right, well, let's move on to number five. This is our final panic. So we've got two panics and two no panics. We're tied. Last one. Obviously, the Raptors' offense, we've talked about how ineffective it was in the first game. So my last point for you is the Bucks' defense, Russell. Do you think the Bucks' defense is what caused the Raptors' issues, or was it the Raptors themselves?
I can't help but think it was more the Raptors themselves. Like, the Bucks are not, a top defensive team in the league. It's not like they're all of a sudden going to make the Raptors, shoot 20% the rest of the series. Like, no. The Bucks had a defensive rating that ranked 19th in the league this year. Mm-hmm. And obviously the team it was a tale of two halves, and the second half was much better. But at the end of the day, they're not world beaters on the defensive end, and they just don't have all the pieces, right? Like, so they have some good defensive players, but they also have some very bad defensive players. Mm-hmm. Greg Monroe comes to mind. Yep. And they've got a couple of rookies and things like that, and just, you know, Brogdon and McCur are like played well and everything like that, but I mean, I don't know if they have the experience to really gut it out and be perfect for a full, you know, 4 to 7 games. So I think a lot of that stuff will regress to the mean. I think the Raptors will definitely have some positive regression in terms of offense. They were one of the top offensive teams in the league this year. I don't think the Bucks are going to be the ones to stop them. Like, there are a lot of teams, they faced a lot of good defensive teams this year and were still able to get their stuff, you know, working. So I'm not too concerned about that. I'm certainly not panicking that all of a sudden the Bucks are going to be like this, you know, unbelievable defensive team.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. I think if you watch the game, anyone who watched the game saw that the Bucks played well defensively. They did okay. They did a lot of things. You know, they scored in transition. They were deflecting some passes, doing things like that. But they were doing well because the Raptors were making kind of incorrect plays. It wasn't that the Bucks were playing so, you know, supremely amazing defensively, that the Raptors were forced to make any of these plays. It was kind of like watching a tennis match with a bunch of unforced errors where the Bucks took advantage of them, as they should have. But for me, I'm not panicked about the Bucks defense at all. I think they have the ability, and they certainly have some guys like Middleton and Antetokounmpo with some length, but I mean, the rest of their guys, when you go through them one by one, there's not a ton of supreme defenders in there that you got to be scared about. The Raptors had their opportunities. They were just missing shots.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Okay, so Russell, we have 3 no panics and 2 panics. So I think we're pretty no panicked right now, which is nice.
Hey, all of a sudden I feel better. Thanks. That helped.
Good. I'm glad. You got to talk it out, talk things out, and then they get better. So, okay, what we're going to do now, we have a ton of listener questions, which is great. As we said, the collective dread in the Raptors fan base has really pushed a lot of queries to the forefront, and I have a bunch here for us. So I'm going to do them in the order that I receive them, and a couple of them are a little repetitive, so I'll combine a few. But okay, so from Laurent, I'm really sorry if I say your last name wrong here. Laurent Baelde, he wants to know about Giannis. He said, what would be your game plan against Giannis? Yes, how do we stop Giannis considering the terrible small forward matchup that the Raptors have with him? Now, just before I let you jump on that, I don't think the Raptors have a terrible small forward matchup against the Bucks. I think one of the things we said in the playoff preview was that they actually have a pretty good in terms of personnel. But we were also hoping that Damari Carroll would be able to do something against him. So in game one, obviously that didn't happen. So what would you do, Russell, if you were game planning to try to stop or slow Giannis down at least?
Oh my God! If our the professional head coach couldn't figure out what to do in that last game, I don't know what chance I'm going to have.
Yeah, I don't think the 29 other NBA head coaches really know what to do with Giannis.
No, really, though. So I don't know. I'd like to see maybe more Tucker on him just because I don't think I was convinced enough with anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be the best thing to see. So maybe that means starting Tucker. I mean, this is a drum we've been beating for a while now. But I don't think that, you know, I think Casey mentioned in post-game comments that he's not ready to even think about lineup changes yet. But I think putting, you know, finding out, and maybe it's not Tucker, but finding out which of your players you're going to really put on Antetokounmpo and make them dig in and that be their assignment and, like, forget about offense, forget about everything else and just really, like, shut him down. I think the biggest strategy now is just to find out who that guy is and to make that his one most important job.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. Follow up from Laurent then, I think because he knew maybe that stopping Giannis is going to be hard. How would you just go about limiting the Bucks' second chance points since they are a taller, lankier team is what he says. Kind of, I think he means their big guys are a little more athletic than ours.
Yeah, I mean, like, sorry, what was the question again?
How do we limit their second chance points?
Get more rebounds.
Yeah, I know, that's fair. I think he just means in terms of this specific matchup. And I think that's kind of a good transition into something I wanted to talk about. The Bucks out-rebounded the Raptors in game one, even though during the regular season, the Bucks were 29th in the NBA in rebound percentage. And since the All-Star break, when the Raptors added Tucker and Ibaka, they were second. So I think that was kind of an aberration. I don't think that's something that you're going to see happen every single game.
No, I think that's fair.
For sure. Okay. Let's see here. Okay. You mentioned what they could do to guard Giannis. Pierre wants to know, should we put Ibaka on Giannis at all during the series? Do you think that's a matchup that would be favorable for Toronto?
That's interesting. I don't think like Ibaka would be good enough on him on the perimeter. And
no.
Like, he would drive by him, I think, at will.
Yeah, I think Ibaka 5 years ago might have had a chance.
Yeah.
But if you watch the way Ibaka plays now, he's still a talented defender and he can still jump, but his lateral quickness isn't quite what it was. He's really, really big. I think he's a lot thicker than people realize.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. So Pierre, and a follow-up to the same kind of a question, said, and this is the reverse of what he wanted to know before, is small ball an option? Could you bring JV off the bench? This is just in theory. I don't think everyone thinks this should happen in game two, but bring JV off the bench, start Tucker, Carroll, and Ibaka all together.
Yeah, I like that, actually. I it's interesting that he brings that up. Because I was looking at some of the lineup data just to try and see what actually worked in that game. And of course, it's all small sample sizes and everything. But the, you know, some of the lineups that actually had the most success were ones with both Carroll and Tucker with Ibaka at the five. So, you know, I don't mind that. Like, if you're going to, like, maybe this isn't the right series for Valanciunas, and maybe he matches up better with Greg Monroe coming off the bench, so you let them duke it out on the second unit type thing. Like, I don't know. Valanciunas has been starting for a long time, and, you know, if you really go to him early and he exerts himself, like, we've seen how that can work well. Like, last year, playoff Jonas was amazing against, like, the Pacers and the Heat, so, like, in the time that he did play. So, you know, I don't necessarily want to bail on him just yet, but if it ends up being like something that you need to do this series based on the matchup, we've seen some interesting lineups this season since the Tucker trade where Tucker and Carroll can both work together as you know, mobile defenders that are both like combo forwards and can kind of guard wings like that, but then also you know, deal with people in the post and stuff too, because they have a bit of size. So I don't think that's a terrible option. I don't think I'm ready to go to it just yet. Like, I think that the Raptors come out and really, like, win this game at home somewhat convincingly, and all of a sudden, like, we're going to be forgetting about a lot of the things we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you're totally right. I think a lot of this stuff is, you know, theoretically. Pierre actually finished his comment by saying, I wouldn't make that change now, but what if they went down 0-2? So I think, you know, that's a pretty reasonable take, something to think about. I think something we talked about on the podcast quite a lot was the Raptors lineups with Ibaka at the five and how effective they were when they were closing games in fourth. And, you know, I remember the episode when you had your Dinos and Digits talking about how incredibly effective the Raptors have been in fourth quarters since the trade. And Ibaka had been playing a ton of minutes at the five in those lineups.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. Well, speaking of guys that are giving us trouble, and you mentioned Jonas before, Greg Monroe had a hell of a game, kind of out of nowhere against the Raptors in game one. 14 points, 15 rebounds. He came off the bench, as he does for this Bucks team, which I don't think was their plan for him, obviously, when they signed him. But he's really kind of carved out a role as a bench scorer for them. He only played 26 minutes and put up those stats. He was 5 of 11, so not incredibly efficient, but Malkin wants to know, is Greg Monroe for real? Is he a concern, or is this, you know, is that just kind of a one-game flash in the pan, do you think?
No, he's had a quietly very good season. He might actually be a six-man of the year candidate, if you really think about it. You know, like you said, I don't think when they signed Monroe that their intention was for him to be off the bench. Their idea was surely for him to be a starter, but Jason Kidd obviously had different plans for him. Doesn't like how he performs on defense, I suppose.
Yeah, he's a bad defender.
Yeah,
actively bad defender. So
exactly, but I mean, yeah. Monroe played 81 games this season, and per 36 minutes, he averaged like basically 19 points and 10.5 rebounds.
Nice.
Per 36 minutes and almost four assists. So he's a guy that, you know, can give you those bursts in small minutes and really, especially against second units, is a guy that, you know, all season long has been having games like the one he had in game one. Like, game one was a very good game, but he's been having games like that all season.
Sure. And I think, you know, the points in the paint thing, it's again, limiting the points in the paint because he can't shoot at all.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, Giannis, you talked about Giannis's points in the paint earlier. So him and Monroe together, you kind of need to, that's it's defending the paint is what you need to be doing.
It really is. Cause I mean, this Bucks team is not a, like, it, that's where the most of the damage is done. Like, when you've got a player like Antetokounmpo as your best player who is not a shooter, then obviously, you know, you need to like the Bucks are a good 3-point shooting team all told. Like, they're top 10 in the league in terms of percentage. But, you know, when it comes to the guys who have the ball most, whether it be Antetokounmpo with your first unit or Monroe with your second unit, those are guys that want to get down low. So, those are the parts that you have to defend. And, like, you know, three-point shooting is not something that's consistently going to kill you. So if, you know, if you need to pack the paint and force them outside, then you kind of have to live with the results. Then if they make a ton of shots, fine. But if they don't, then you're golden.
Yeah, they do have 340. They stay. Brogdon shot 40% from three this year. Middleton is over 40%, and Tony Snell, as we mentioned earlier, is over 40%. So they do have some sharpshooters, but none of those guys is what you would call like a volume 3-point shooter. There's no guy, like a Klay Thompson or J.R. Smith, even guys that they're going to shoot 8 and 9 threes in a game.
No one you look at and you automatically think it's going to bury you if he gets hot, right?
Exactly. Yeah, they're guys that hit it when they're open and they shoot it really well. But given the fact that you have those two guys with Giannis and with say Monroe in the lineup or McCurr, like neither of those guys can shoot at all. So from the mid range or outside, really. So you know who you need to be guarding, and if you defend the paint, I think good things will happen.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I messed up the name on that last question. Sorry, guys. Pierre Caratti was the one who asked that last question. Malkin's question here is coming up now, Malkin Pinto. And he wants to know, how about using Norm Powell more, considering that Carroll has not been really good on defense? And do you think that we see... He has two questions. He wants to know, using Powell more, and do you think that we see Bebe at all in the series?
No, we talked about this prior to the... prior to the playoffs and how playoff rotations tend to get shortened.
Yep.
I don't necessarily think that Norm Powell is an automatic answer. Like, he's inconsistent as any, you know, second year guy picked in the second round would be. So, and I don't mean to keep giving him that label, but at the end of the day, like, you know, there's this concept and it like James Johnson before him, where people think that this guy on the bench who has these flashes of being very good and having these like really useful minutes would all of a sudden be fantastic if you just gave them all the minutes. And I think that's the case here with Powell. I think that, you know, when you look at the players up and down, it's not like, you know, I've been calling for Tucker to start in place of Carroll, but I'm not ready to dismiss Carroll as a player to have on the floor as an experienced guy, right?
Yeah.
Who can hit the three and who can defend. So Norm Powell, maybe for a different look every now and again, like peppered in, fine. But I don't think all of a sudden that he should bump anyone from the rotation. Because as we talked about leading up to the playoffs, their 8 or 9 man rotation is very solid.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think Powell, like Ross before him, is actually a two. He's better suited to be a two. And the Raptors have a very good two in DeMar DeRozan. So there's just not that much opportunity. If you want to play him at small forward, I mean, you can. He's able to do it in smaller lineups, but then he's guarding what, Middleton or Antetokounmpo. Like he's gonna get worked by those guys just in terms of how big they are.
That's a very good point.
And I guess you could have him guarding Tony Snell, maybe, which he could probably handle, to be honest. But even Snell is taller than Powell. Now Powell's got a good reach, and I think people, when they ask for Powell, when they see these defensive struggles, they're remembering Powell versus Paul George in the playoffs last year.
Yeah.
And that was great. Like it was a really cool thing to see a rookie come in and really give Paul George, you know, the business, and, you know, he wasn't afraid, but I mean, it's not like he shut Paul George down. Paul George had an awesome series against the Raptors
exactly
last year. So just the fact that, you know, he got down low and was, you know, grabbing his shorts and getting up in his face. I mean, it was the antithesis. That's twice I've used that word today.
It's antithesis, a really good word, though.
Thank you. Of Terrence Ross. So I think a lot of people were like, oh, wow, look at this guy. He's playing some defense. He's on the perimeter. And I get it because I like Norm Powell. I like him a lot. But I don't think he's a really great matchup against the Bucks, who are so long and athletic.
No, and I mean, I think you made an excellent point talking about, like, if you just look at the Raptors' players and the fact that Powell is smaller and maybe more of a two, like, if you've got DeRozan in the playoffs playing maybe 40 minutes a night, and you have to think of the rest of the time, like, how much time you want to have, like, Lowry and Joseph on the floor together, for example, because those bench lineups with the two point guards are generally so effective for the Raptors.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, there just doesn't seem to be enough time to go around. So if it comes to like taking minutes away from Carroll or Tucker, I'm not ready for that to be absolutely the answer. Like could Powell maybe, like you said, in some instances or some plays, you know, really get up into someone like he did with George last year? Yeah, perhaps, but I'm not ready to, you know, be based on that, give him all the minutes. So he could be like, you know, break when in case of emergency type player, but I'm not ready for it to say that he should, like, this is going to be the reason the Raptors lose games because they're not playing Powell enough.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree there. I'm just trying to find this question that we got sent to us on Twitter. Inside the Cylinder asked, and we've heard a little bit about this today, what were your thoughts about DeRozan's response to the Giannis block? Should the tech be rescinded? Well, since that question was sent in, the tech has been rescinded. Russell, I'd like to hear your thoughts about that whole incident.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to what that was, Antetokounmpo stuffed DeRozan, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And then he, you know, yelled or basically celebrated it, and DeRozan took exception to it and looked like he wanted to fight him over it. And then Antetokounmpo got teed up. So basically that whole thing, it comes back to what we talked about, even like funny enough, like the discussions we had about Lance Stephenson's bucket and these unwritten rules and, you know, players should be allowed to, you know, express themselves to an extent. Like you're playing playoff basketball and Antetokounmpo had a huge game. His team like was the underdog coming in on the other team's home floor and beating them. And he was having a great game, and he had this great, like, definitive play. And, you know, he let the moment not get the best of him, but, like, his emotions came out. And I don't think he deserved I don't think people deserve technical fouls for that. Like, if there's no ill will, like, he wasn't, like, right up in DeRozan's face and trash-talking him or waving his finger at him or doing anything. He just kind of, you know, let loose a yell. And I think that he was justified in doing that. I'm glad they rescinded the technical because when it happened, I thought, like, that wasn't really worth a technical foul at all.
No.
So if anything, I had a problem with DeRozan as they were getting creamed, like, not having the maturity to, like, just accept, okay, you're getting beaten. If you don't want him yelling about it, like, dunk on him next time.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, I don't think it should have been a tech. There's absolutely no way. People are allowed to have displays of emotion, particularly in the playoffs. Young guy, and that's the kind of stuff you'd like to see from your players in the league. I don't think the NBA needs to be any more like the NFL. Exactly. In that kind of a you know, that manner. The NFL has even just talked recently where there was a whole article was released about how they're going to relax their rules because people like that stuff. So, yeah, I think I don't really care about DeRozan's either. He was pissed off. But, yeah, you'd think that you'd want to see him just kind of, you know, put the head down and just do it next time. But I don't have a problem with either one of them, but I am glad the tech was rescinded because I don't think he should have got it. Cool. All right. So, okay. This is a big one, Russell. A lot of fodder here. Andrew Pace. When Andrew, I hope I said your last name right. P-A-E-S. Pace. I think it's Pace. Can we ask why Casey still refrains from making calls on the fly? For example, leaving Corey Joseph in when he was getting torched on both ends. It was the same with T-Ross the last couple of years. What did you have an opinion on that, Russell? What do you think? Why do you think Casey is kind of slower to adjust?
No, that's a really good question. It's something we've discussed a lot over the last couple of years in the playoffs when things have happened where we've wanted to see an adjustment more quickly. But I don't know if it's just because we have the benefit of, you know, seeing things like live and taking, like, being able to focus on certain things. I think in the heat of a game, I'm not meaning to defend him in any way, shape, or form or what's happening, but I'm curious if things that seem so obvious to us, if there are other layers to things that we don't quite see as fans just watching it on television. And maybe it simply comes down to, like, really wanting to give other players the proper amount of rest and just saying, like, okay, we'll get through this portion, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
I'm curious to hear your opinion on it.
Yeah, Casey's really loyal to his guys, right? I think that's the biggest thing. He's very old school. Someone tweeted, it was a joke earlier, but it just for posterity, Dwayne Casey is 6 years older than Jack Armstrong. also, Jack Armstrong is way younger than everyone thinks he is. Jack Armstrong is younger than Leo.
What?
Yeah. He's like 5 years younger than Leo, I think.
How in the... okay.
Yeah. No one thinks that's true. Jack, I think, is only like 53 or something like that. So,
He's aged horribly.
it's all the Bacardi. All the Bacardi and MGD. for anyone who...
Draft man.
Yeah. Gotta get on lift of the Jimmy. We could do Jack Armstrong impressions.
Like, listen,
all day.
I like Jack Armstrong. I take back what I said about him aging horribly, but I think it's getting a bit like on the broadcast, those moments where Matt Devlin does some form of read of an ad and he just like yells it.
Yeah. Like, about Assassin's Creed or
yeah,
whatever else he was to. Yeah. He's done some really good reads this year.
Yeah. But yeah, that whole thing is getting kind of like, oh, okay, guys.
It's aggressive. Well, Matt and Jack have just turned. They decided, I think they went to Tommy Heinsohn school this off season and just decided to just rip the referees just constantly.
That's the thing too. The guys are getting a bit out of hand with the homerism and the referees and the no call. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I used to love Chuck Swirsky and I still love Chuck Swirsky. I thought
of course,
he was fantastic.
Happy to not.
But he was a huge homer, and he used to do the, oh my goodness, when there's like, that's not a foul. And like, even Leo and whoever was working with Jack would tell him to calm down. And one of the big things when Devlin came is Devlin was a big adjustment from Chuck because he's so different. And like, over the last few years has really let his personality show through a little bit more. But he's a real pro, and like, he does the games... a pro's pro kind of thing. He does games for other teams when the Raptors are eliminated. He's a kind of highly sought after dude. And so for him to start going into the homerism with Jack, especially with Jack, is kind of weird. It's just a weird look.
It is, yeah.
It's not something I would have ever expected.
Sorry, what was the point we were making there?
The point I was making is that Dwayne Casey is old. And he's older than Jack. He's about the same age as Leo. I think he won an NCAA championship in the 70s as a player. He's been around for a long time, and he's really loyal to his guys. So I think he's kind of the mindset that you give the guy a chance to prove it, and then you make the change before the next game. I don't think he likes to change things in the middle of the game, because then people are unsure of their role. Don't know when changes are coming. He likes to kind of be accountable to his players and have his players be accountable to him. As someone who's played sports, I'm never obviously at a professional level. I appreciate that. But I also think that when you're in the NBA and it's the playoffs, it's, you know, the highest level of competition. There are times when you need to be more flexible than that. And that's definitely an Achilles heel for him, I think.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I think, you know, I never looked at it that way, but it's true. I guess that is what he's doing, is he's trying to be consistent for his players. Like, if you want them to be consistent, then you should be consistent as well. And if, you know, if they know what they can expect from you, then they'll, you know, they'll have the confidence to, like, you know, if they miss a shot, they won't feel like they're looking over their shoulders type thing.
Yeah.
But and that's fine to set up that culture all year round. But maybe, yeah, when you're in the playoffs and every possession counts, there might be a time when, you know, you have to make that adjustment. And I guess you're right. He does make game-to-game adjustments more than in-game things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it can be frustrating at times, but I'd say there might be times where not, you know, the positive evidence doesn't come to mind as quickly as the negative evidence, but you know, there might be times where that has served them well, and you know, sticking with a guy that, you know, us armchair coaches may have pulled him earlier, may have, you know, from time to time may lead to some kind of sparking some kind of comeback or something. So, you know, it's hard to say sometimes. But yeah, I'd like to, maybe it'd be nice to see more. But I don't know what I would do in his position either. You know what I mean? So That's why I find it hard to criticize coaches sometimes, because I really don't know what I'm talking about in terms of like X's and O's and a rotation and stuff. It's not like I could step in and do that job tomorrow. Like I really couldn't. So as much as I can look at a coach and say like, oh, I wish he'd, I don't know, for an example, like I wish he'd play JV more, but obviously I don't know what goes into making that actually a reality. So it's, you know, I know enough about it to talk about it on the radio. But beyond that, you know, if there's certain things that we can criticize and certain things where we kind of got to go like, you know, we don't know any better.
Yeah. Well, and I think that people forget that, like, he has to talk to these guys every day and like exist beside them. And, you know, he's not playing 2K.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you don't know what motivations these guys are going through. You don't know how people deal with different types of criticism. You don't know who needs what, who needs the pat on the back, or who needs to be yelled at. All those things are huge when you're coaching. And I'm someone who's coached for a long time. And that stuff exists even at the lowest levels of sports and at the highest level of sports. I think managing egos is the biggest thing that a successful coach does. People talk about Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson had the X's and O's of the triangle, but he always had assistants running that stuff for him. He was the ego manager. He was the guy who got Jordan to, you know, agree to be on a team. He's the guy who got Kobe and Shaq to coexist, even for a short period of time. And, you know, he's the guy who, you know, wound up ultimately being the most successful. And being able to do that is a real skill. And, you know, if you look at the Raptors and you look at those guys, we were talking about attitude and stuff earlier, the Raptors are not a team that's ego-free. You know, Kyle Lowry has an ego, has pride. Serge Ibaka, we saw him again in a fight with Robin Lopez earlier this year, has an ego, has pride. And if they're the guys who are leading the team, and DeMar DeRozan shows, you know, his pride all the time and, you know, how hard he works and everything that he puts into himself every offseason. So all this stuff is intangible gobbledygook to stats people, but that's why basketball is a bit different than baseball, a bit different than football, those kind of sports. The intangible stuff is really, really important. Chemistry is humongous on a basketball court. Anyone who's ever played even pickup basketball can tell you that.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure. So I think in terms of Casey, I think actually last year in the playoffs, he did a pretty good job of switching things around. We talked about, or just earlier, about Norm Powell, you know, guarding Paul George. That was not the game plan in game one of the Pacers series. So we'll see if he makes game-to-game adjustments. Another question here that I'm going to talk about in a minute, I'm just trying to find it, has to do with Jonas Valanciunas. And that might be something that we see a little bit more of. I know you mentioned him just now. I wish they played him more. But I think we'll see the game-to-game adjustments if they need to be made. But I think this Raptors team has been good enough this season that a massive adjustment before game two isn't actually necessary.
No, you want to act like, you know, the coming back to this idea of they've been there before, they have experience, like they don't want to look panicked. Like they lost game, they lost a game to the Bucks at home, fine, but you have to come out still being like, okay, we're still the favorites in this series. We win this game and the next game, and all of a sudden things are right back the way they're supposed to be. And yeah, I mean, there's not enough evidence to me to make me think that the Bucks still have a, like, really have a chance of winning this series, even, because I still look at what happened and the fact that, like, I don't see the Raptors shooting 20% for a half again.
No.
You know what I mean? And I don't see Lowry, like, okay, going back to what we said earlier, maybe I can still see Lowry stinking this much, but
yeah,
I don't think necessarily everyone's going to be, you know, a negative outside of DeRozan and Ibaka again. And I think they're going to come back heavily motivated and really laser focused. So it's one of those things where I don't think making any big adjustment right now is going to make it look like you're the inexperienced team or like you're actually concerned about losing to this team, because, you know, you should be concerned about losing to a team, fine, but the Raptors should still feel like they're supposed to win this series.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Okay. I'm still looking for that Valanciunas question. I'm going to get to that in a minute. We've talked a little bit about this, but I want to know what you think specifically. We didn't really talk about this bit of the question. Vic Baines wants to know, we've talked about the Raptors struggling in game ones historically. Vic Baines wants to know why. Why do you think this is something that's happening? Is there any explanation for it, or is it just complete luck of the draw? Because this is, you know, 4 years in a row for this team, this kind of group of players now. It's not the same group that was here 4 years ago, obviously, but is there any tangible explanation for it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been asking myself that a lot these last few days because, you know, I really tried to defend them, like, going into this game when people were saying, oh, you know, it's a game one, you know, the detractors being like, you know, oh, I guess, like, making just, there were so many jokes made on Twitter and in various articles about the Raptors, and, like, pretty much you can chalk this up as a loss because it's the Raptors at home in a playoff game one. And, you know, as much as I defended it and was kind of like, no, it's not true. And then it happens again. So I'm trying to think of, like, why in the world does this happen? Like, I always try to think about that. Like, when people talk about historical trends of teams, when the teams have changed so much, like you made that point exactly, like 4 years ago, yes, Kyle and DeMar were there. Valanciunas was there. But, like, you know, a lot of the parts have changed since then. And compared to now today, it's like, why would a team with, like you mentioned, Tucker wasn't there and Ibaka wasn't there? Like, why does the team, like, why is it, can you say, the Raptors always lose this, or the Raptors always lose that, because it's such a different team? So at that point, do you look at the common points? Like, do you look at Kyle and DeMar and just say that, like, you know, they choke in big games, but we've seen them also win game sevens? So I really don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just the pressure of that moment with the whole, like, that concept, is it a gift and a curse, the whole concept that you have a whole country behind you and that everyone really, really cares about it, and, you know, you got people out in Jurassic Park and you got all this stuff going on? Is it, like, too much almost?
Mm-hmm.
Like, to the point where if you get down, you just want to turn it around and get that square jumping, and you want to, like, you want to really rally the fans and figure out what it is that can turn that around. And because I found, like, a lot of times near the end of the game, I found myself saying, like, they were down and I wanted them to get back, but I found that they were just launching bad threes. And it's like, just get good baskets, get your stops, get good baskets. You don't have to make it all back with a couple 3-point shots. And it's that, I think that they fall back into those patterns. And now, whether that's coaching or whether that's the leadership of Kyle and DeMar, I don't know. I really don't know. I wish I knew. And because if we did know, I mean, that's something that should be solved by now. Like, it's almost silly that last year, in a year when they went to the Eastern Conference Finals, the two series that they did win, that still happened. They still lost game ones at home.
Yeah, it's vexing. It's more than anything. I think everything you said is very apropos. Makes sense that there'd be pressure, and there's pressure on them each year. The Brooklyn year, there wasn't maybe as much pressure, but, like, it was the first team, the team had made the playoffs in so long. The Washington year, the team just wasn't very good, and they were hurt. So last year, then, you know, they had that whole, I think last year was the first year I started to hear about how bad they were in game ones. I think people realized it before that, but it was kind of more like a joke, like, this is kind of whatever. Now it's become, like, a real thing. It's almost like you have the monkey on your back, and it's almost like this. It's just the evolution of them not being able to win a playoff series.
Yeah.
That was the whole thing that people kept throwing out. And, you know, the Raptors can't get past this team, or can't get past that team, or they're never going to be able to win a series. And now it's just the new, which is the thing that, you know, you're not going to have that many opportunities to actually do it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, man. I don't have a real answer, Vic, for Vic's question. I think the pressure thing, like you mentioned, is a real thing. Especially given how much pressure Lowry and DeRozan put on themselves. Like, if you follow the team at all, you know how much pressure those two guys put on themselves and how hard they've worked to become better players, whether it's Lowry getting in better shape or DeRozan just living at the gym and the evolution that he's taken as a player. But they can't be just that. I think obviously there's going to be some luck sprinkled in with it there. And it sucks. It sucks more than anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I found the question about Valanciunas. I can't find the name of the person who asked it to me. Sorry to whoever this person is. If I find your name, I will put it there. He wants to know, could Valanciunas be the difference maker in the series, especially when Greg Monroe is on the floor?
Yeah, I think he could, because, I mean, they would go toe-to-toe. Valanciunas is a very good rebounder. Like, the fact that Monroe got 15 rebounds, like, you'd have to think that he could, if he spent more time, like, exclusively matching up with Monroe, there would be, he'd win some of those 50-50 battles on the boards. Mm-hmm. When it comes to what happened the last couple of years with Valanciunas and just how well he performs in the playoffs, it's one of those things where I'd really like to see him. I'd like to see them go to him and like maybe try to make that a thing again and just see how it works, because it's a different look, right? Like, I know that DeRozan has come a long way, but if you're going to, if like the Kyle and DeMar struggle show is going to continue, like Valanciunas really bailed you out of a lot of games last year. So maybe the major adjustment, it doesn't have to be like change the starting lineup or anything like that, but maybe just see what kind of look you get if you go to Valanciunas. Like, I know he's not the first option. I know the whole team shouldn't run through him, but maybe go to him for a couple plays early on and see if you can get him going. See if you can go on a kind of a run with him. Like, I think he could be a really interesting look, because we talked about that too prior to the playoffs, where we were saying that this team can do so many different things. Like, the Raptors can hit threes. They can, like, DeMar can work a possession. You know, Valanciunas can be effective down low when given the opportunity. So it's one of those things where, okay, well, what you normally do didn't work perfectly the first time in game one. So, you know, maybe you don't have to make a big swing adjustment, but, you know, try the little things, a couple possessions at a time. See if you can do something a little different than your initial game plan and see if you can get something going. And if it works, stick with it. And if it doesn't, then try something else.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's the best way to use him, is to go hard at McCurr at the beginning. He's a young man. He played really good defense in the third quarter, but Jonas is a very skilled scorer in the post, and he gets guys in foul trouble. We've seen him do it before. Especially if Lowry is struggling with a shot and kind of wants to ease into the game, although I'd like to see him score some early points and be aggressive. DeRozan, you can use DeRozan whenever. He's not like he needs to take 10 shots in the first quarter to warm up. Going to Jonas at the beginning and kind of setting the tone that way, I think is a really good strategy. I also think that if you give the ball to Jonas and you're using him in the post, that could really limit the Bucks' ability to get out in transition, because typically transition and half-court offense, you know, on one end does not lead to a ton of transition on the other end unless there's a crazy steal of some kind.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that would be a really smart thing for them to do, is to go for some more post touches when they can. If that forces the Bucks to put in, like, John Henson or put in, you know, Monroe's obviously, we talked about that he's not a good post defender, and the Bucks don't have a ton of good post defenders. So I think that's somewhere that Toronto could really have an advantage if they use Jonas properly. Jonas. I keep calling him Jonas. I'm sorry, Jonas.
I know. I keep wanting to call you on it too, but I leave you alone.
You should. Do it. Every time. Call me every time. If you get a bell or something or a buzzer.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Let's see here. I know we have more listener questions, but I'm struggling to find them right now. So I'm flipping around. Okay. This one is from John Gaudis of Raptors HQ. And he wants us to rank, this is really depressing, but, you know, we've been going kind of in a good direction this whole time. We might as well go. He says he wants you, Russell, to rank your three most deflating Raptors playoff losses of this era.
Oh my God, dude.
We don't have to do that. He asked a different question as well. But I think that's a good... that was Woodley. That's Sean Woodley, also of Raptors HQ, not John Gaudis. Sorry, John, to put that one on you. Woodley, you're a sad man. You're a sad, lonely man. And we're not answering your question. just calling you.
I can give it a shot.
Do you want to do it? Okay.
Like, I'd have to look at a bunch of box scores and kind of like, you know, get to give a definitive rankings, but
yeah, maybe just pick your worst one.
There's got to be something from that Wizard series. Like, you might have to refresh my memory as to which one, but there's definitely stuff that went on in that series where, like, there were games when I felt like I checked out, like, midway through the game.
Yeah. Game 3 of that series, I remember, was bad. I wrote one of my favorite articles I've ever written about DeMar DeRozan in that series, about how he was kind of giving everything he had, even though the team was kind of collapsing around him. And I really hoped he was going to come out and, like, lead them to a win in Game 3, and then I think they just got murdered. So
yeah, that's definitely up there. I think the Game 7 against the Nets was up there too, and not simply because it was like it wasn't a bad loss, but it was just that the depressing nature of it being so close and it being a Game 7 at home.
Yeah, that's a bad one for sure. And then the final play and everything. For me, actually, if you want to talk about it, this is funny. Woodley, your question might have been good. the worst one for me was Game 5 in the Cavs series last year, because the team was 2-2, and everyone was like, the Raptors are 2 wins away from the finals. This could really happen. Bah! And then they just got ripped. They got just absolutely murdered in Cleveland. It was in Cleveland.
It was in Cleveland.
Game 5 was in Cleveland, and it was just a bloodbath. Like, I remember I went to a bar with my friends to watch it. We were in Toronto down on Queen Street, like, all excited. You know, the whole bar was full of Raptors fans, and it was just so deflating just from the jump. So I think that's my number one, actually.
Yeah, I think now that you mentioned it, I'll put that one in there. So I'll say Game 7, Brooklyn would be third. Maybe, like, a Washington game would have to just to kind of represent the series would be second, mm-hmm. So the third one's a good one. And then That Cavs game, you're right. That was horrible, simply because it was just at that point where you finally had yourself talked into, okay, maybe they play a close game 5. It comes down to the wire, and either they win it or they lose it and they go back to game 6 with their heads held high. And yeah, that's not what happened. Now, I'm sure that I could also pick any of the game 1 losses at home where they should have won them. Like, even the most recent one, because there's never been, like, of the last four years of this era, as Sean put it, this is... Sorry. That was the game I tried to move away from the mic. Hopefully that worked. That was the game 1 I most expected them to win, like, and to really get that monkey off their back. Like, I was like, there's no way they're losing this game 1 at home to the Bucks. Like, mm-hmm. Respect to Giannis and respect to what the Bucks did in the second half of the season. Like, the Raptors are a better team. They should have won that game, so that really pisses me off. But yeah, we'll go in that order. We'll go number 3 would be the game 7 against Brooklyn. Game 3 against Washington would be number 2, and number 1 would be Game 5 against Cleveland in the Eastern Conference Finals last year.
That's fair. And I think I was going to switch to Washington ahead of Cleveland, but I went back and read the question again, and it's deflating, not depressing.
Okay.
So deflating makes it a big... I definitely will put that Cleveland one first. That was the whole city got deflated. So
yeah.
Okay, John Gaudis. And we kind of were... Someone had asked this question earlier when they were talking about putting Norm Powell in. I think it was Malkin. John wants to know, should Bebe get a chance to play... in the series, given his ability to pass out of traps and just his passing in general. Do you think that that's a small change that they could make even as early as game 2?
I suppose so, but again, with the shortened rotation thing, I think that the concept of, like, you can't really take too much away from JV because he's effective in those small spurts and he could be a big spark offensively.
Yes.
And so you can't really, and he's a fantastic rebounder, so you can't really take that away. And yes, Bebe is a better passer, I would say, but the fact that your options are to take away from Jonas's minutes to make that happen, or take away from combinations with Ibaka or Patterson at the 5, which are, like, other things I don't want to do. So,
Completely fair.
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to find time for him. Like maybe for, like a, you know, this whole concept of for a different look every now and again. But I have a feeling that's not going to end up happening. I just think that the his how much he's limited on the offensive end would come into play.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that if you look at the box score even from game one, and obviously that's not a great game, Poeltl only played 2 minutes.
Like there was there was garbage time there.
It was garbage time, right? So he's not even really going to be in the rotation unless there's foul trouble. If you want to ask if Bebe should maybe take that job, like maybe, like you could think about it, but I don't know. I just don't see, unless Valanciunas is completely rendered useless, then I don't think that's what you're going to do. Maybe if that, I mean, if that does happen, if there's a, you know, the Bucks are doing such a good job on him, but I think if that is happening, you're in a place where Bebe is probably not going to save you.
Yeah, and that shouldn't happen in this series, really. Like even in game one, he put up 9 and 9. Valanciunas did, and I just think with the matchups with like Monroe and stuff, it's going to be hard to render him completely useless. I don't think that it's a terrible matchup for him. So,
yeah, that's fair. So no, John, your question's dumb.
No, it's not. Keep asking questions.
It's not. I'm just kidding. Please always send us questions. John is a friend of ours via Raptors HQ. That was why I was being a little silly with him. But no, yeah, thanks guys for writing in and to everybody who wrote in. Russell, we got a little time left here and we are now out of listener questions. I'm still on the Twitter and the Facebook trying to get some more. But we can talk about game two now.
Yeah, like why don't we prep that, preview that?
Yeah, definitely. Totally. So game two is tomorrow night. Obviously, it's in Toronto again. What do you need to see? What are you expecting to see?
I really want to see a good start. You know, this team has had a problem with first quarters, and they've gone down early a lot and had to come back. You know, they led the league in comeback victories, double-digit comeback victories. You don't want to, you know, if you lose game one on your home floor to the Bucks and you come in, like, I want this to be a wire-to-wire win. Like, I think that things really – and that's what I think part of the reason why – I want to see them go to Valanciunas early is because I think that you can, that's a really good way to get some solid points early on and to and like not rely on like shooting or not rely on this or that happening. Like I think he's fairly consistent when utilized.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I think the main thing I want to see is a really good start.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I like to see them be really aggressive off the jump. Like, sometimes when they do go to Jonas early, he likes to try to do the slow dribble, kind of get warmed up. I don't want to see any of that. I want to see quick, decisive moves. I want to see him kicking it back to Lowry or DeRozan or whoever if he doesn't have good position. And I mean, he gets the ball so little from them that obviously every time he gets it, he wants to put it up, and that's what he should be looking to score anyway. But he's gotten better this year at kind of kicking it back and doing little handoffs and things like that. So, that's one of the ways you can stop them from trapping. I think if you know that they're going to trap Jonas as soon as he touches the ball, then you prepare for it before you even hand him the ball. Maybe you throw one in, and if they trap, you have someone getting in there right away so he can hand it off quickly. There's little things you can do like that to kind of throw a wrench that makes them think before having to trap. If they can just trap every time and they're forcing you to react to it, that's a problem. So there's ways to counteract trapping. I mean, there's a reason teams don't double team every play every single time that you're on the floor, right? So
yeah, absolutely.
I think that that big start, a good start, would be really important. Obviously, the Raptors played really well in the second quarter last game. They were down, I think it was 30-22 after the first quarter, and they were winning at half. They were winning early in the third quarter. So I think if they hit their open shots, and I think if they just kind of keep it together. It's like the old school gif of Will Ferrell just banging the chair on the locker. We got to keep our composure. And he's just screaming and not really keeping his composure. But they do need to keep their composure. I think they need to remember they're the better team. They've been here before. They were conference finalists last year. The Bucks are going to do some things that they don't like. But you really do want to see them come out and really just take care of business. I think that's... for game two, that's what you want to see from Toronto.
Absolutely. And I think you made some excellent points there, Dan, about like decisiveness and really setting the tone, because I think that the big thing here is that in the last game, when they got down, things started to look frantic. Like, they did not look composed at all. And that's something that has been a big thing for this team this year is being able to come back and not losing your cool. And it just seemed like they lost their cool. They seemed too frantic. Like, they're running around and you know, throwing bad passes and dribbling into traffic and just doing all this stuff that was very on Raptors. And I'd like to see them really just establish themselves again in this next game and just make it a wire-to-wire win. I think that would solve a lot of issues and put things back into a good place for this team.
Yeah, totally. Do you hear that, guys? Stop fucking around.
Yeah.
Basically.
I mean, it'd be good, too, if Lowry hit a couple shots early. And,
totally.
Just got his rhythm going, because it's one of those things, whereas if he misses two or three shots to start, you can kind of see it snowballing out of control again.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, Toronto, Ibaka is kind of this for them now. They lack the kind of the irrational confidence guy out of one of their two superstars. They're guys, DeRozan and Lowry, have worked so hard to get where they are that they're very aware of their own limitations and they're very aware of their own game. So when things start going badly, they also know what's going wrong. We talked about this, I think, 2 weeks ago when Ibaka had that game. It was Lowry's first game back. And Ibaka had missed, I think, his first five or six three-pointers. And when they threw it to him for the next one, he shot it. He shot it right away. He didn't hesitate, and he buried it. And it was a huge moment in the game. You need that attitude. You need to know that what you're doing is the right decision, even if your results don't always match. And that's something that you see from Lowry and DeRozan. To borrow a Canadian hockey term, they're kind of gripping the stick too hard sometimes. They're holding on too hard, and they just want it so bad that they need to just almost scale back 20% and just play the game. They know how to play.
Yeah, completely. So, I think that's a very good analogy, actually.
Yeah. Any Given Sunday, man. I watch a lot of sports movies. Any Given Sunday, the part where Al Pacino says to Willie Beeman, he's like, You remember when you were a kid, you played football on the street, and you just told your friend, run to the Buick, turn, and I'll hit you. That's what you got to do. You're playing a kid's game. And that's what they got to do. They just got to keep playing the kid's game. And if they do that, I think they'll really, really be fine. There's, everything we've been over with the Bucks. The Bucks are not scary. They have talent, but this team is better when they're playing their best basketball.
Yeah, and that's the main point in all this. The Bucks are not scary. This is, like, they had a good second half of the season. They have a very, very, very good player in Antetokounmpo, but overall, it is not a scary team. It is a middle-of-the-pack team. There's a reason they're the sixth seed. And that's it. The Raptors really need to take care of business here. So obviously you can't lose this game, because that would put you in a horrible position. So, like, don't mess around. Don't give the Bucks an opportunity to win this game. I think the Bucks too, they're playing with house money right now, right? Like, there was the concept of when they came into game one, you were talking about the pressure being on the Raptors. The Bucks had nothing to lose, right? Like, they, through most of the season, it looked like they weren't going to make the playoffs, and then they made a late surge and they made it. So, you know, they're here as a bonus. So if they win a game or whatever, then it's a successful season for them, right? Because they're still putting their pieces together. Jabari Parker is out and stuff like that. So, you know, the expectations aren't that high, and no one's expecting them to get to a second round. No one has been talking about, like, the possibility of the Bucks playing the Cavs in the second round or anything like that. So that's
no,
you know. So you don't want, like, they won their first game on the road. They did their job, right? So now they've got home court advantage in the series, as crazy as that is to say. But they don't need to win the second game on the road. So I don't know if, you know, that's something that as the Raptors you can't let them do, because they shouldn't be able to do that to you as a top seed. I find one of the interesting things, though, and something that we haven't mentioned yet, but I wanted to talk about, is the fact that I we're down on the Raptors because we're Raptors fans and analysts, and but we look at all the top seeds in the Eastern Conference, and each team has seemed flawed in some way.
Yes.
Right? Like, you've got the Cavs nearly lost game one at home. Like, the defending champs nearly lost game one at home. It came down to a last second shot that if the Pacers had hit it, that would have been it. And, the Celtics obviously lost their first game at home. The Wizards beat the Hawks, but, I mean, it's not like the Hawks have been really like spiraling down. I think of all the lower seeded teams, they've been the worst, right?
Yeah. We wanted the Hawks. Yeah. That would have been a great first round series for Toronto.
Exactly. So, you know, no one has looked perfect. It's not like you're looking at the Raptors and saying like, okay, they have no chance of coming out of the East now. Like, you know, beforehand we were talking about, we were doing the playoffs preview. We were discussing like this Raptors team might be something, a team that you have to take seriously as a potential finals contender, because the Cavs looked so flawed and stuff like that. And, you know, they still have not like gone through stretches where they look terrible on defense. So, okay, maybe again, they haven't had to turn on the switch yet, but like, when the hell do they turn on this switch?
Where is this switch? Is there a switch?
Is there a switch? Like with the players they have and everything like that. So I think at the end of the day, the Raptors, as much as like that was deflating losing that first game, to use Woodley's term in his question there. Yeah, it was a deflating loss, but I don't think it necessarily puts them way down the chances of advancing out of the East. Now you have to think that they're still, you know, top. I would say like, I think I saw the odds today, the updated odds, out of Vegas, and they're still the third rank there behind Cleveland and Washington, because Washington took care of business and won their first game, and they're in the other side of the bracket, and Boston looked flawed. So all of a sudden Washington looks like, you know, a good bet to maybe make the conference finals, but, you know, Raptors are still right there at number three. So, I think ultimately
they have game 7 at home if it gets there. Sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
They do. Yeah. I mean, no, it's okay. It's an excellent point. So it's one of those things. I don't think there's any reason to panic. Overall, I was very disappointed. And I, like you brought up it right off the beginning of this episode. I completely, it was in a dark place. I was sad, but at the end of the day, I still have a lot of confidence in this team to win the next game, to win the series. Will they make it harder on themselves than it needs to be? Yeah, probably. But at the end of the day, what really matters is how they perform in this next series after this one. And I still think that as much as I don't want to look past it, I don't want to underestimate the Bucks, you know, this is still supposed to be the Raptors' win.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what? To finish things off, this day in Raptors history, this podcast is going to be airing on game day, April 18th. This day in Raptors history, the Raptors beat the Bucks and tied the series 2-2. Tied the series 1-1. I'm going to go ahead and just say that. It's going to happen. So,
all right. I like a little bit of...
That's how it's going to finish. I really debated not saying that because I do believe in sports karma. But you know what? I think we've earned some karma as Raptors fans.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's fine. And I think it's going to happen tonight. So... thank you so much to everyone who sent in a question. Please send in questions. We're going to record again next week. We might do a shorter one later in the week or something like that. We'll let you guys know on Twitter. Russell, where can the people find us?
People can find us all over the place. If you're looking for us on Twitter, they can find us at We The Rapscast. If they want to find us on Facebook, they go to facebook.com/WeTheRapscast. And if they want to email us some of these for this question period that we do, they can write us at wetherapscast@gmail.com.
Remember, we are We The Rapscast, and this is a Toronto Raptors radio show. You can find us on Dash Radio at 4:30 Eastern on Tuesdays. It's an hour and a half show, goes till 6. And you can find us in podcast form on iTunes, Stitcher, almightyballer.com, and everywhere else that podcasts can be found. I use Podcast Addict on my Android, and you can find us there as well. I am Dan Grant at Slam and Danny G on Twitter.
And I am Russell Pedal at Rusty Pedal Bike on Twitter.
And get out the salami and cheese, mama, because this podcast is over. Whoa, whoa.